KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in West Menlo Park.
Haight-Ashbury.
I live in the Western Addition.
Bernal Heights.
San Bruno.
Coming up, women were early pioneers of computer science, so when and why did they stop coding?
A lot can shake your confidence. You can be sitting next to a male student who could say, "You don't know that, and you're a computer science major?"
Then a local woman opens the tech industry up to young Black girls.
We're seeing them take the interest that we plant the seed in our classes and take it far beyond what we ever anticipated.
And remembering the Apollo 11 mission with one of the women who made it a reality.
Finally, later, the lunar lander got back up to the spacecraft. I was in tears.
The history of women in tech today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, most of the big names in technology are men. But actually, many computing pioneers, the ones who programmed the first digital computers, were women. And for decades, the number of women in computer science was growing. That was until 1984, when something changed. That's the year the number of women in computer science suddenly flattened and then plunged. Today, the team from NPR's Planet Money brings us the story of why women stopped coding. Here are the hosts, Caitlin Kenny and Steve Henn.
Caitlin, I spent some time trying to immerse myself in 1984. Figure this out. And there isn't an easy answer to the question. There was no grand conspiracy in computer science that we uncovered. No big decision by computer science programs to put a quota on women. There was no sign on a door that said, "Girls, keep out." But something strange was going on in this field. I mean, if you look at other technical fields, mechanical engineering, physics, math, the percentage of women kept growing, trending up. I mean, in some of these fields, it moves slowly, but it was always going up. In computer science, the opposite started happening.
So to try to figure out what happened, let's go back to a computer science class around this time. The year, 1984. The place, Johns Hopkins. The class, Intro to Mini Computers. One of the students in this class was Patty Ordonez. And Patty was exactly the kind of person you would think would end up majoring in computer science. She says from an early age, she was a math geek.
The math teacher actually realized that I was really good, and she started giving me more exercises, and I started getting tutored with this other guy. So we did math on recess. So it was kind of cool.
In high school, kids in her class called her the math genius. And when she got to college, she thought, computer science, no problem. I got this. But very quickly, her confidence vanished.
I had that first class of mini computers. And I remember this one time I asked a question, and the professor kind of looked at me and he stopped and he just said, "You should know that by now." And I thought to myself, I'm never gonna excel.
And there were these other kids in that class, guys actually, who seemed to know everything the professor had to say before he even said it. Actually, there was this one guy in particular, Lee Van Dorn.
I just thought he was a friggin' genius. Oh, can I say that word? Sorry. I just thought he was a genius. So he just looked like he knew so much, and he was always on the computer, and he was so enthusiastic about it.
I wanted to track this genius down, ask him how he seemed to know all the answers in this class in advance. I found him. He works in Seattle now. But Lee doesn't consider himself a genius. He said, yeah, that class was easy because by the time he got into class, he'd already been programming for years.
And one of the first programs I wrote was an application for my mother to manage her bookstore inventory.
Lee wrote that program when he was 15 or 16. He actually converted it into machine language so it would run faster on his tiny little computer. So when he got to college, he nailed his computer science classes. He did really well. Today, he's a tech consultant for an energy company. But Patty's experience was totally different. She struggled through that computer science class. Eventually, she changed her major. The high school math geek ended up majoring in foreign language.
So this is one of the big changes happening in 1984. When that line on the graph starts to plunge, there were starting to be computer haves and computer have-nots. In 1984, you couldn't succeed in a computer science program without having had a home computer. And this bled into the workforce. Even if you weren't studying computer science but you wanted to work on it, you needed the experience of using one, of playing with one. It was like Lee had taken the secret prerequisite that Patty didn't. Lee had a computer at home. Patty could have had one, but she didn't. So how did Lee end up with one? Well, he said it was in this store that he used to love to go to, Radio Shack.
It's one of those life-changing moments, you know? So I walked into a Radio Shack store, and there sitting on the counter, the front counter, there was a TRS-80 Model 1 computer. And essentially, it's nothing more than like a black and white TV set with a little box attached to it with a keyboard on it. But what was running on it was a little game, and it was like a little Star Trek game. And you essentially were the captain of the Starship Enterprise, and you would go to different quadrants and encounter Klingons and destroy them and shoot photon torpedoes and things like that.
Star Trek, Radio Shack. Early home computers popped up in the places that were already the world of boys. And it wasn't really a surprise Lee wanted a computer. There were these ads around the time telling him to buy it. And the ads for personal computers, they were filled with boys who looked a lot like Lee. Here's one for the computer that Lee saw and fell in love with, the Radio Shack TRS-80 color computer.
Some people have big plans after school. You know what Elliot's going to do? Jeff, too.
The opening shot is these two boys getting off a school bus. A dorky boy with glasses, Elliot, and a sporty boy holding a football, Jeff.
Elliot's at work on a book report using Scripcit on Radio Shack's Color Computer 3. It hooks up to his TV. And Jeff's at his Radio Shack Color Computer 3 playing the newest football game.
And here's another ad for Apple.
This morning, Brian Scott made a career decision. He decided to be an astronaut. His first giant step, learning to use an Apple.
Let's just throw one more at you. This one's for the Commodore 64.
Are you keeping up with the Commodore? Because the Commodore is keeping up with you.
Steve, I gotta say, you and I have spent a lot of time now watching loads of these early computer ads from the 80s. And what's so striking about them, besides the super cheesy 80s music, is men and boys. In this Commodore 64 ad, there's sort of this dorky 12-year-old sitting at his computer, and he gives this finger salute to the camera. In fact, in most of these ads, it's just men, all men.
Actually, there was one woman in this ad. She was in a bikini, and she was jumping into a pool.
People who study women in tech, they talk about ads like this. Early in the 80s, when computers were moving into the home, they couldn't do that much. There was one really good selling point, something exciting they had going, and that was that you could play games on them. So they were marketed to kids as toys. And just like most toys, the ads were targeted to just one gender.
Jane Margolis is an education researcher who's now at UCLA, and she has a theory about this.
You're saying when computers entered the home, they entered the home the same way like Tonka trucks entered the home.
Exactly. Exactly. They entered the home as all the toys that involved work with tools, all the toys that are associated with science and math.
And so boys tended to play with them more. Dads tended to spend time with their sons doing it.
Yes, and brothers and groups of boys.
It's kind of hard to say if this was straight up sexism by computer manufacturers and their ad agencies, or if they had data that boys were a better target market. But whatever it was, it fed on itself. In the 1990s, Jane Margolis interviewed hundreds of computer science students at Carnegie Mellon, which at the time had pretty much the best program in the country. And she went and asked these young men and women about their earliest experiences with these machines. Turns out the story of Patty and Lee was pretty typical. Take this one student Jane interviewed named Lily.
She was the one who was really into computers in high school. But even though she was the one who was really into computers, the computer was placed in her brother's room.
Margolis interviewed every student studying computer science at Carnegie Mellon, and the pattern was striking and consistent. Another student told her a story about having to ask her brother for the key to the computer because it was actually locked away from her in his room. Now, you could point to that and say, okay, that's an extreme example. But Jane Margolis didn't find the reverse. There were no stories about boys having to ask for the key to the computer because it was locked away in their sister's room.
Once you have something like this happening, it reinforces itself. Computers are for boys. They are boy toys that boys use to do boy things. And this became a narrative, this story we told ourselves, like an actual story in movies.
Okay, look, you know how you're always talking about how you can simulate all that stuff on your computer? You know? What's the difference? Why can't we simulate a girl?
This, of course, is Weird Science, super classic 80s movie. It stars Anthony Michael Hall. It was directed by John Hughes. And if you haven't seen it, here's a quick plot summary. These two high school nerds get together and decide to try to use a computer to create a woman. They connect a Barbie doll through a series of wires and electrodes, and then lightning hits the house, and the smoke clears, and out of the closet steps this hot woman.
So, what would you little maniacs like to do first?
If you think about it, a lot of stories like this begin appearing around this time. Revenge of the Nerds comes out in 1984. War Games, 1983. And it's not just in Hollywood. Journalists fall in love with geek boy culture, too.
And it's not only that the stories glorified the nerdy boys and their computer. They actually started to push women out of this world, to make them feel not welcome.
In 1984, Steve Levy, the legendary technology journalist, published his book Hackers, The Heroes of the Computer Revolution. All the heroes are dudes. And here's a quote from the book. It's about women. It's kind of an exchange. Quote, "You knew that horribly inefficient and wasteful things like women, they burned too many cycles, occupied too much memory space. Then one of the hackers asks, how can you tolerate such an imperfect being?"
Jane says you can see the effect of these movies and books. In her work at Carnegie Mellon, she found that half the women who went to school for computer science ended up quitting the program, dropping out, just like Patty did.
Because if you're in a culture that is so infused with this belief that men are just better at this and they fit in better, a lot can shake your confidence. You can be sitting next to a male student who could say, you don't know that, and you're a computer science major.
And these kinds of slights, they add up. One of the remarkable things about Margolis's research is that a lot of the women who were dropping out were actually great at this. More than half were on the dean's list.
Margolis had some idea about how this had happened. Computers come into the home, they're marketed to boys, and then culture glorifies the geeky tech male. But she wanted to figure out how to stop the clock, how to reverse this, how to find a way to get women back in.
Margolis did her research with a guy named Alan Fisher, who was the dean of computer science at Carnegie Mellon at the time. So the two of them end up taking what they learned and tweaking the program. To give girls a chance to make up for what they missed in those years when boys were messing around with computers in their bedrooms, Carnegie Mellon added an intro course for students who didn't have a lot of informal computer science experience. They started paying a lot more attention to teaching.
And it worked. In just 5 years, they turned the school around. By 2000, 42% of the computer science students at Carnegie Mellon were women. And the dropout rate for men and women was basically the same.
Across the country, other schools have done similar things and had success. Harvey Mudd, the University of Washington in Seattle. Turns out this is not an impossible problem to solve.
As for Patty, who was scared out of that computer science class and went on to study foreign languages, she eventually went back. She got her PhD in computer science, and today she teaches it at the University of Puerto Rico.
That story came to us with permission from our friends at NPR's Planet Money. It originally aired in 2014. And you can find links to more of their work at our website, kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The tech industry isn't just a male-dominated space. It's a predominantly white male space. Electrical engineer and computer programmer Kimberly Bryant says when she was in college, she was the only black woman in her graduating class. When she had her own daughter, Kai, she wondered what she could do to get more young girls of color into the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. So in 2011, Bryant launched a company called Black Girls Code to teach young women how to build their own websites, make computer games, and train them for careers in the tech industry. Since then, Black Girls Code has expanded to cities around the world. And this year, Kimberly Bryant was a finalist for the San Francisco Chronicle's Visionary of the Year Award. I sat down with Kimberly Bryant back in 2014 to talk about the program, and we were joined by her daughter, Kai.
I think some of the same challenges that I face as a woman, I face as a woman of color. And I think the race piece as an extra bit of a complexity to my journey as an engineer in the field of technology. So isolation and being in this field that's dominated by white males can be intimidating to people of color that are going into the field of technology for the first time. I think the lack of exposure in our communities and underrepresented communities to this field, there's not going to be a lot of computer scientists in the inner city neighborhood as your next door neighbor. For the most part, you just don't see our kids that are coming through these underrepresented neighborhoods and inner cities and in areas where they don't have access to lots of Stanford's not next door, or there's no one that really is in the field of technology. That lack of exposure plays a part because they don't even know that it's a thing. So most of the kids that are coming through our programs, they don't know what computer science is when they come into our first class. They don't know what it is to build a website and how they get an app on their phones that they're using on a day-to-day basis. So not knowing is half of the problem that we see with our kids.
So you were inspired by your daughter.
Yes.
Your daughter is here with us.
She is.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
So are you part of this because your mother is an engineer? Is it in your blood? Tell me about what subjects you liked in school and what do you like?
Well, from early age, I had an affinity, I guess you could call it, for technology and video games. I just played them all day, and my mom obviously wasn't too happy about that because she didn't like me being such a consumer of other people's things and of their products. She wanted to see me being my own entrepreneur and making my own games.
And so is that primarily one of the ways that you bring the girls in? And is it expected that they then stay in this industry, or can they then, like, do you give them the tools to branch out into other fields within tech?
Yes. So we try to introduce the girls to all different phases of technology. So we do web design, we do mobile app development, we do game design. We're just starting to get into robotics and more of the electronic side of technology. But we really try to introduce them to as many facets of the industry as possible, because we're not really sure what's going to tap into what girls' interests, and we want to make sure they know everything there is that's available to them. We really try to build these classes around their interests. So they're into web, they like to spend time on the web, they like mobile, they like fashion, they like art, they like gaming. And so really building our workshops around those things that they already like is kind of the hook that gets them excited. So we're saying, oh, well, you know how you play this game? Now you can create one. And that really gets them like all in, where they really take it far beyond what we teach in classes. So I have girls that are in our program that we taught them, say, an introductory course in Scratch, that are now learning to do more complex game design on Unity, which is another professional platform that gamers use. I have girls that are building mobile app sites at their home and putting in them the Google Play Store, putting in them the iTunes Store. I have girls that are doing robotics, and we just do a little robotics at Black Girls Code, but they've done things on their own. So we're seeing them take the interest that we plant the seed in our classes and take it far beyond what we ever anticipated.
Do you think, coding means literacy today? And if you don't code, then you are behind, you will be behind, you will be left behind.
I often hesitate to say that everyone should learn to code, and it is the same as what we would consider basic reading literacy. But it is an important literacy for our youth of today because technology touches everything. So no matter if they want to go into the arts, if they want to go into medicine, if they go into a more scientific career, in each of those, they will be utilizing technology in some form or fashion in the course of their work. So it's critically important that they at least understand the language and understand how to communicate in that language to the folks that are working around them to do their jobs and to get their jobs and their goals done in their careers. So it is a critical literacy that our kids must learn, but not the only one. It doesn't replace the basic reading, writing, and arithmetic in my book, but it is a necessary addition to the skill sets that we need to empower our youth with.
So I'm not a girl anymore. I'm a woman, Kai, and I don't know how to code. Is it easy to learn?
It depends on what you start with. I mean, obviously you can't go like straight into some hardcore Python probably unless you go
Python.
Really, really slow or something like that. But you just have to just maybe if you want to learn it on your own, just look up some tutorials and they should be pretty straightforward. And many misconceptions that my friends have and many people I know have is that coding's too hard, I can't do it, it's only for smart people. Mm. But that's not the truth because you are smart, they are smart, and you can do it just like anyone else can. You are just as good as them, they went through the same struggles, and they started at the beginning just like you are if you're going to learn how to code.
That was Kimberly Bryant and her daughter Kai talking about Black Girls Code, a company designed to get more young women of color into STEM fields. Kimberly was a finalist for the San Francisco Chronicle's Visionary of the Year Award, and she'll be speaking on a panel at St. Mary's College in Moraga on Thursday, April 27th. Find all the details at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. Now we're going to head inside the StoryCorps booth for a first-hand account of a remarkable moment in history. Diane Daniels was part of the team of IBM programmers behind the Apollo 11 mission back in 1969. She was joined in the StoryCorps booth by her friend Patricia Fodor.
I was only 22 at the time, pretty fresh out of college, so I was working on the test module for the telemetry system. The telemetry, just for everyone's knowledge, is the communications between the ground control computers and the computers that are in the orbiting spacecraft. And that was really difficult to do when we first started putting stuff up in the sky. With the moon landing, all of a sudden, we have a lunar landing module, so we have the spacecraft orbiting above the moon. We've got a rover that's going down to the moon, and then, my God, we have two guys who want to get out of it. I mean, I think as a programmer, I might even have said, well, can't we kind of limit the functionality here? Because this is really getting complex.
This is hard.
it's really hard. And that, we've just had this two-way conversation between ground control and the spacecraft, and so now we're going to have something, a third one on the moon. And then when you think of each person who got out and two different men walking on the moon, each of them were a separate communications module. So we had five modules that we had to make sure we didn't drop any bits. I mean, if we drop a bit, maybe then we lose track of them. They can't get off the moon. Fast forward a year to the actual moonshot.
Buzz, this is Houston. F2, I'm at the 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
And I was in tears, Pat. Part of me was terrified something wasn't going to work. That all of a sudden he's going to step out of the module and something in the communications would break down. And Neil, where are you, Neil? We can't find you, Neil. And I'm going to think, oh, my God, I was responsible for testing this. It was me and 800 other young programmers.
But you felt that personal sense of responsibility even
yes.
after your job was done.
Yeah, I'm going to step off the land now.
And when he got back in and finally later the lunar lander got back up to the spacecraft, I was in tears.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
So anyway, fast forward another 6 or 8 months and I'm back in Washington, D.C., and we have a little reunion of many of us who had worked on Apollo 11. Not one of the men owned up to any type of emotional feeling when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. You know, I cried. And so the rest of them, oh, yeah, sure. Of course, we wrote it. Of course it's going to work. So, you know, you wonder, it came out beautifully. And so you have to give credit to the management structure that was all white male who made it work. You can also say as a female programmer, I was one of the few female scientists working on the system. And I think it was really the first time I really started to understand some of the cultural biases that result in so few women going into math, which was my major in school, or sciences. And so I was lonely, and it made me raise my consciousness to see how can we help other women get more engaged in engineering so they could experience the thrill of being a part of something as exciting as putting a man on the moon.
That was Diane Daniels and Patricia Fodor in the StoryCorps booth in San Francisco. If there's someone you've always been wanting to interview, bring them to the booth. It's located in the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library right now. And that's it for Cross Currents today. The production team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, Chris Hoff, Judy Silber, Kovalroop Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wang. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.